keep watch. I come unannounced like a thief. You're blessed if awake and dressed, you're ready for me. Too bad if you're found running through the streets naked and ashamed. The frog demons gathered the kings together at the place called in Hebrew. Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer on your Mad Men Machine Show 144, Armageddon. Crisis. 2009 will be an economic crisis. That's from Thomas Dolby's 1994 album Gate to the Mind's Eye and his lead track, Armageddon. The Mad Money Machine is proud to be brought to you by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com, who share none of the opinions of this show. Here are the topics we're going to cover today on show 144. GIMP for images, Z-Buds, money and inflation, National Freedom Day, arguments against indexing, the Learning Earning segment number 5, CEF versus GTU versus GLD versus GDX. We will have a spin at the Guru Roulette Wheel. The perils of ultra shorts. Mint.com feedback. And how to calculate your portfolio's standard deviation. Let's get right to it. So I listened to Econ Talk a couple of shows ago. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. Russ Roberts. He talked to Eric Raymond, the author of The Cathedral and the Bazaar, a book, an article, first of all, and then a book about open source software and the benefits of it. And one of the things they talked about, Russ brought up in there, was GIMP, the GNU Image Manipulation Program, and reminded me of that program. I haven't used it in a long while. A long time ago I used it, and it was just clunky. But it's gotten better. And with this move to the Macintosh, my Adobe Photoshop, of course, does not move with me unless I fork out some Federal Reserve notes over to them, which I do not wish to do. So I have downloaded GIMP. The image that came along in this show was manipulated, copied it from the internet, and then manipulated using GIMP. It's the logo for show 144, Armageddon. So I'm going to be playing with GIMP, looks like. Z-Buds. I bought some earbuds for my iPhone. I wanted some earbuds that had the microphone built into the cord. And I wanted to get some earbuds that would be more tangle-free. Now, these sounded like the perfect solution. The cord on these earphones is actually made out of a cloth cord. The old-style cords that you would have in high-end audio equipment. And I bought a pair of these. They were a little bit pricey. And I bought them on the 11th of December. And come the 21st of January then, they stopped working correctly. What happens is when I move the cord against the plug into the iPhone, it shorts out. And by shorting it out, it effectively hits the pause button, pauses the music or whatever it is I'm listening to. And so I wrote an email to their customer service feedback. I said, hey, I'd like a refund or a replacement on these things. Just bought them a month ago. Gave them the order number. They emailed me back and says, we are sorry. You ordered these more than 1 month ago. Our 1 month warranty is no longer in effect. We can't do anything for you. It was a month and 10 days that these stupid things stopped working. So I cannot recommend Z-Buds to you. I can recommend ones that I'm using right now as I'm recording this show, and they're from Radius, and they're a little cheaper, made a little less. They're made more cheaply, I guess. They're just the typical plastic cord covering the very thin wires. They do have a microphone and a pause button on the left ear cord, which is different than the iPhone's actual microphone on the right ear cord. The website for it is radiusearphones.com. And in the show notes, there's a coupon code to save $5 if you want to buy a pair of these. They sound pretty good. They're in-the-ear earbuds, not just the not just the metal ones that fit sort of inside your ear. These are the little bulbs, the buds, you know, the actual pieces of little rubber that go inside your ear. Well, today, January 30th, is National Freedom Day. And the Campaign for Liberty has sent out a little thing. They suggest that you call in some radio stations and talk about some of these points on National Freedom Day. On the economy, for example, they say the congressional pay raise scheduled to automatically take place in 2010 should not be allowed to go through. They should have to cut back and sacrifice just like their constituents. Second point they make is during these tough economic times, stopping the pay raise would show that Washington is serious about fiscal responsibility. They say economic freedom is based on a very simple rule. Everyone has the right to his or her life and property. In the United States, many citizens seek to use the government to enrich themselves at their neighbor's expense. This is immoral. We should stop using the government to do things that would be considered morally outrageous if done by a private individual. Why should we expect a system based on legal theft, as ours is, to be a net benefit to the poor or middle class? Every one of the special benefits that have been enacted by both Republicans and Democrats makes companies less efficient and competitive and the economy more sluggish. There should be no income tax, national sales tax, or any other such scheme on a federal level. The U.S. income tax implies that government owns you and graciously allows you to keep whatever percentage of the fruits of your labor it chooses. This is incompatible with the principles of a free society. I'll have a link to all the rest of National Freedom Day bullet points. You can read them for yourselves in the show notes of Show 4144. Oh, this dilemma about where does money come from? Where do the banks, where do we get the money to pay the interest back to the bank that creates the money? And I got an email from Stan, and I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy Stan's email and paste it into drop.io/madmoneymachine. You can see it out there. That'll enable you to read the details. But bottom line is, he says, imagine a bank which has $200, loans out $100 to each person, a farmer and a clothes maker. And the banker expects $110 in return from each. The question becomes, where does the added value come from? And the bottom line of the story is the farmer, by being able to buy clothes, is able to be more productive in the fields, grow more corn. The clothier, by being able to eat corn, is able to be more productive and make more clothing. So by having this money, they were able to add value to the economy, and therefore able to pay back to the banker what they've added in value. And he actually says in here, if they did not, the banker would end up better off with the money, which is now worth more than if they hadn't paid back created the additional money, I guess. One of the things, though, is that the bank didn't have $200, is my point. You know, the bank loans out nothing. The bank creates something in a spreadsheet somewhere and says, all right, you now have $200. And when it gets paid back $210 or $220. And it gets the $20, which wasn't created anywhere. You know, they created the 200. I don't know. This is all crazy. I need an authority. I need to read a book about monetary policy and figure out what is going on with this fractional reserve banking business. Maybe I'll read Murray Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money? Or maybe I'll read his other one, The History of Money and Banking, and see what is going on with money. This portion of the show is brought to you by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Check them out on the web right there. We're looking at the Learning Earning segment where we learn how to earn our financial freedom. And I've been working through the IFA investment principles. There are 7 of them. We've already done 4. The first one was capitalism works on average and over time. The second one was risk and return have a positive correlation. Remember that? Number 3, free markets match prices to current levels of uncertainty so that buyers can earn a risk-appropriate return. And last week's number 4, the greater the risk, the longer the time required to obtain the expected return. Well, this week, number 5 in their IFA investment principles, passively invest, diversify to the maximum, maintain a small and value tilt, and keep turnover, costs, and taxes to a minimum. So let's take a look at the first one, passively invest. Let's look at the difference between 2 investment strategies, active investing and passive investing. In active investing, your objective is to beat a market. In index funds investing or passive investing, your objective is to obtain the return of a market, index, or asset class. What about average equity individual investor returns over 20 years? Oh, here's a good one. For active investors, according to a Dalbar study, for the 20-year period ending 2004, the average equity return for an individual in active investing was 3.7%. In passive investing, S&P 500, 13.2%, and an index portfolio 100 at IFA, 15.32% annualized. How about the state of mind between these two approaches? Active investing, stressed. Index fund investing, relaxed. How about proponents of the various strategies? Proponents of active investing include virtually all brokerage firms, mutual fund companies, market timing services, investment press, and brokerage training programs. How about who are the proponents of index fund investing? The University of Chicago, Nobel Prize recipients, Vanguard Group, Dimensional Fund Advisors, Barclays Global Investors, Warren Buffett, and Charles Schwab and Company. How about analytical techniques for active versus passive? In active, the analytical techniques are art, qualitative, disregard for risk, forecasting, predicting the future, feelings, intuition, luck, betting, gambling, speculation. In index investing, on the other hand, analytical techniques include science, quantitative, risk management, long-term statistical analysis, and accurate performance measurements. Their next part of the investment principle, number 5, is diversify to the maximum. We've talked about how their index funds approach their portfolio invests in 17,000 companies. And what this does, if you look at a chart of the diversification of risk and expected return, if you're invested in one particular stock, you have a very high degree of risk that stock's price is going to move dramatically. If you combine your portfolio into 2 stocks, the risk is somewhat reduced. You're combining the swings of those 2 stocks, but it's still quite high. 3 stocks, it comes down even more. all the way down to 500 stocks in the S&P 500. The standard deviation there still is about 20%. But look at an Index Portfolio 100. Standard deviation, a little bit less than that. The risk that you're taking is less. The next part of the investment principle says maintain a small and value tilt. And what this means is instead of investing in the S&P 500, which is mostly made up of large company stocks, what Fama and French have demonstrated is over the long term, smaller companies, which have a little bit higher risk, actually have a little bit higher return correspondingly. And value companies also have just a little bit higher return than growth companies of the same size. That's why a portfolio shifted just a little bit more towards small companies and a little bit more towards value companies should have a better expected return in the long run. And finally, keep turnover and costs and taxes to a minimum. It's obvious, isn't it? If you keep more of your money, you'll have more of your money. Learning Earning, brought to you by Index Funds Advisors. Folks, I'd highly recommend that you go to their website at ifa.com and take their risk capacity survey. That'll be the first place to get you started. It'll figure out how much risk you should be taking with your investments. At the end of it, it'll give you a portfolio number. It's kind of like the sleep number mattress, if you want to equate it to that. So if you end up with, say, a 40, it'll show you how much you should have in stocks versus how much you should have in bonds. And if you look at the details of those portfolios, it breaks down how much you should have in U.S. and in foreign and emerging markets and long-term bonds and short-term bonds and international bonds, the whole bit. It's all set for you. Very easy. Take the risk capacity survey. Learning Earning, Index Funds Advisor. And I spoke earlier about drop.io, where I'm going to place Stan's email. Brian put an article out at drop.io. Arguments against indexing. He has thoughts from the Frontline Weekly Newsletter from John Modlin. And it's kind of a long newsletter that goes into. But basically, the bottom line is he complains about the Dow Jones Index and says that stocks in there are using a price-based index rather than a market cap index. And he laments the fact that Microsoft, for example, if it went to zero, the Dow would lose 136 points, which is less than 2%. But if IBM, with a smaller market cap than Microsoft, went to zero, the Dow would lose over 700 points. But it gets worse. And he goes on and on about this, how some of these stocks are, you know, there's this unwritten rule that stocks in the Dow Jones shouldn't get below $10 or else they get tossed out. Well, look at Citibank, $2.80. General Motors, $3.50. Bank of America, $5.10. Alcoa, $8.85. And goes on and on lamenting this index. Well, I think other indexes are weighted properly. They're market cap weighted, which is a good thing. I know... Two, one of the good things about Dimensional Fund Advisors is theirs is a little bit more active than a completely passive index. I mean, they take some rational approach to it. They look at special situations where some of the small stocks are issuing shares, and they take advantage of buying in bulk when they can to get a better price on the shares that they're buying. And I'm sure they look at dumb things. I mean, if there's something just totally obvious that you wouldn't want to buy that stock, like maybe they've announced, we're going to go bankrupt in a couple of months, so don't buy our shares, then they probably wouldn't buy their shares. Not that that ever happened, that specific example ever happens, but they do take a rational approach to indexing. So take a look at drop.io. You can read the rest of John Modlin's article. I wouldn't buy the Dow Jones index, but I think S&P index is just fine. Did just a little bit of homework on this business I talked about on the last show, this Central Fund of Canada, Central Trust Fund of Canada. There's actually an article at Seeking Alpha, Jason Hamlin, The Safest Ways to Invest in Gold and Silver from December 17, 2008. And this is where he talks about the Central Trust of Canada, ticker symbol CEF, or its all-gold counterpart, the Central Gold Trust, GTU. He says that unlike popular ETFs such as GLD and SLV, these funds do not lease out your gold, and they always maintain 90% or more of assets in unencumbered, segregated, and insured passive long-term holdings of gold and silver bullion. He points to articles by James Turk and others that talk about some of the unanswered questions about the other ETFs, GLD and SLV. He also talks about how this Central Fund of Canada might have a better tax preferences, being a foreign trust fund instead of a collectible. Like to see an IRS audit on that. So I'll have a link to that article in the show notes. You can take a look and see whether you want to buy an all-gold fund where they hold the gold for you. Ticker symbol GTU. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Madman Machine Show 144 is Mark Faber. Well, it's appropriate on this show titled Armageddon that Mark Faber would show up on the roulette wheel. He is the author of the website, the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report at gloomboomdoom.com. And I'll have a link to a YouTube interview that he held with Bloomberg in which he says, "We are at the beginning of the worst economic contraction since the Great Depression." He says, "Recovery won't come until 2 or maybe 5 or even 10 years' time. The market may go lower even from here." He says 2009 is going to be catastrophic, economically speaking. Monetary policy led to the excesses in leverage and debt growth we have, and the rate of inflation will now accelerate. Interest rates will increase. Markets will drift lower because they're not compelling on price to earnings or dividends or book values. He said commodity prices now, after the huge setback, are relatively low, and that Asian markets are low and stocks are probably okay, but could go down even more. Investing in gold and even gold miners, and in particular in perhaps oil and oil companies, could be good at this point. He says U.S. government is a bigger Ponzi scheme than Bernie Madoff, and that the S&P may go up, but we have to look at the underlying currency, relatively speaking. In other words, if we get inflation and the dollar drops, then it may look like the S&P value is going up, but it's really the dollar is going down. Well, you can check out the video for yourself. Congratulations, Mark Faber. You're the guru on Madman Machine Show 144. I also got a question or a comment, actually, out at drop.io. Someone talked about the perils of ultra shorts. There was an article at thestreet.com, I believe it was. I'll have a link to it. And coincidentally, the article mentions Mark Faber. And he had predictions at the Barron's Roundtable at the beginning of 2008. He actually did pretty well. He said that he would short the China fund, FXI, the China index. And he got a good call there because that index was down 46.7% in 2008. He said another way to play it, though, would be to buy the ultra short fund, ticker symbol FXP. And I think the idea of this is it's supposed to go up 2 times for every one down FXI goes. If FXI goes down 1, this ultra short, FXP, is supposed to go up too. Well, what happened in 2008? It did spike up there in October-November timeframe, if you look at a chart of it. But after that, it collapsed. Collapsed, absolutely collapsed. At the end of the year, the ultra short fund was down 57.2%. And that's what this article is seeking, not seeking alpha, at the street.com. points out is these ultra shorts, you know, they've actually got a statement in there that says, quote, actually, this is a quote from the article at thestreet.com. He says, furthermore, the purveyors simply highlight that these seek to replicate plus or minus one time or two times the daily returns, and that they, quote, do not seek to achieve their stated investment objective over a period of time greater than 1 day, unquote. And he says, despite presumably knowing full well people do not view mutual funds as one-day holds, but indeed, investors are sent a prospectus when they execute a trade, meaning that there is at least 3 days price risk before they even get the prospectus. And that alone is enough to cause damage. Well, so buyer beware if you buy these ultra shorts. I know I've talked about buying the SKF and the SDS and the FAZ, and they've all not done well for me, not done well at all.
Station about the coming of a great fireball. Thunderclouds are forming, locusts started swarming. Heaven ain't a place for us all. Well, our eyeballs were appealing when the wind blew out the ceiling and the horsemen came a barreling down. We did the Armageddon boogie,
Armageddon boogie,
the Armageddon boogie,
Armageddon boogie,
boogie on down the line. We did the Armageddon boogie,
Armageddon boogie,
Armageddon boogie,
boogie,
boogie on till the end of time.
So I asked if any of you have been using Mint.com to keep track of your finances. Carl emailed me, and he said, I have been using Mint for nearly 2 years now without any hint of regret. Although the security issues did give me pause in a real big way initially, they make some very salient points on their site about this very issue. After a lot of very close scrutiny and substantial chin scratching, I came to the realization that they're right and jumped in. With just an account or two in the beginning, after a bit of time, I gradually added the rest of my accounts. They're still in beta and are very friendly and quite responsive to any suggestions on how to improve their service. In fact, they've even taken me up on a couple of ideas, adding features I've suggested within a couple of weeks. All in all, they've saved my bacon many times over these months. But the biggest single thing they've done is to make managing my entire money picture fun and easy, all without my needing to become some sort of bean counter type. No offense to those accountants and bookkeepers out there. With only one click, I can quickly see the answer to most of my queries about a myriad of money concerns. Life is sweet. Hope this helps the discussion. That's Carl in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Well, thank you so much, Carl, for weighing in on that. Also got an email from Alex in Tennessee. And he says he wants to provide some information on Mint. Mint is a third-party website front-end for the account aggregation provider Yodlee. And Yodlee is also used by many financial institutions' websites like Bank of America's My Portfolio. Keep in mind that not only do these large banking institutions trust Yodlee, the software product Microsoft Money also collects its bank account information from Yodlee as opposed to directly from each financial institution that you have an account with. He says he's used Yodlee for over 2 years now through Bank of America's My Portfolio web interface, and it has made planning and budgeting extremely easy. I can now track my net worth, category spending, monthly and weekly cash flows, and identify banking credit card charge errors quickly without the manual work of importing a file from each banking website and then laboring through the transaction registers, removing duplicates that I associate with Quicken and Microsoft Money. I track my checking, money market, 401k, PayPal, Scottrade, Vanguard, credit card, and credit card cashback rewards all from this site. He says you can set up an account directly on Yodlee's site at moneycenter.yodlee.com. That's Yodlee, which is completely free. The interface is often streamlined a little better on financial institution websites like Bank of America, so make them your first choice. The disadvantage of being tied to a financial institution is that you will lose your long-term historical trend graphs if you ever leave the bank. And in the end, he says, some people say they don't know how to save. I think that's because they aren't using Yodlee to tell them when they've been bad. Thanks, Alex in Tennessee, for that feedback. Also got an email from Ben asking about the lazy portfolios and wanted to know if there's an easy way to calculate the standard deviation for a given portfolio of funds. And when you read about the standard deviation of funds or stocks, what is the time frame used for the price changes, monthly, daily, every minute, whatever? Well, that's a very good question. The first part of your question, I would say no. There is no easy way that I have found anywhere to calculate the standard deviation for a portfolio, for a given portfolio. Now, there's two places that I've used in the past to do such things. Foliodex.com, when it worked, could sort of calculate the Sharpe ratio, which includes the standard deviation. But it doesn't seem to work anymore. I don't know why. The second place I've seen is at bogleheads.com. There is a spreadsheet some guy put out that calculates standard deviation for a portfolio of Vanguard funds. All Vanguard, only Vanguard. And I might dig that up and see if I can post a link to it in the show notes. But if you're in any kind of funds or stocks other than Vanguard, then this spreadsheet won't do any good. Now, what I've done is created a spreadsheet on my own. It's a horribly designed spreadsheet. I mean, I really have to do a lot of manual grunt work to get it working with standard deviation and so forth. The one that's at Bogleheads, that spreadsheet uses a monthly change or monthly change in prices to calculate standard deviation. Or is it yearly? It uses yearly changes in stock prices to calculate standard deviation. My spreadsheet uses, I believe, monthly changes in price for standard deviation. And I think that's the way IFA calculates their portfolios, is on a monthly price change basis. How much time frame should you have? Ideally, according to statisticians, you should have 20 years of data. Talk to your financial planner about getting 20 years of their past performance. Well, thanks for the email, Ben. If you have a question, comment, complaint, or criticism, here are some ways to get it to me. Feedback@madmoneymachine.com is the email address. You can call the voicemail line, 571-366-7121. You can comment right there at madmoneymachine.com in the blog notes. You can comment for all to see out at drop.io/madmoneymachine. You can Twitter me at twitter.com/madmoneymachine. You can Skype me at madmoneymachine. Or you can take the MMM survey, second column at madmoneymachine.com. I'm so glad you joined me this week. I hope that 2009 does not turn out to be Armageddon. I'm Paul Douglas Boyer, saying it takes money to make money, and it takes Armageddon to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next Friday. In the meantime, visit our... Visit the company that brings you the Mad Money Machine, IFA.com, Index Funds Advisors. Helping investors succeed by matching people like you with portfolios. And check out all the songs having to do with Armageddon from the PodSafe Music Network.